How are you this morning?
Good, good. How are you, Jeffrey?
Good. Is Doug?
Hello.
You're on mute, Doug. There you go.
Thanks. Is my audio clear enough to understand me?
Yeah.
Good, good. Still have storms passing through here and usually provides poor connection. Good to see you guys. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, Doc, how's it going?
All right. Busy morning.
Are you busy because of family or busy because of work or?
Because of work, I thought I had things situated where I could take care of things and be here and be present, which I do now at this point. But it's a little bit of trouble getting it all settled in.
Yeah, I have a paper due today, which is ready, but it needs a few more retouches before I send it in. So,
What's the paper about?
it's about a method of it's a technique for dealing with mental health issues called body mapping, where people draw an outline on the on paper of their own bodies, and then they fill the outline with expressions of their own anxieties or whatever it is they're looking at. But I've been developing 3D immersive ways of viewing the body maps using our augmented reality. So it's an
Cool.
interesting paper. An interesting paper, but I'd forgotten that I had to do it until 2 weeks ago, so I've had a very busy 2 weeks.
Hey, thanks for the link to the Paradise Lost text with the hyperlink. So it's or whatever.
The Dartmouth College one,
That was cool. I like that.
yeah. I noticed that on Amazon or electronic books that when they say annotated, they don't mean what I think they should mean, which is that kind of thing. You know, they don't have, instead, it's just a set of comments in a separate text, but not linked into the, you know, I remember the Norton Anthology days where you had extensive footnotes for everything.
This is the Norton Critical Edition. I don't know. Well, I got it when I was undergrad. When I think I got it, but it does have. I mean, I like when the footnotes for a poem, if it needs footnotes, are actually like at the bottom of the page. And
Yeah, that's what I remember.
yeah, but this has that, which is nice. Yeah.
Because you kind of need some help reading this text. We'll see how it goes when I read it aloud, but and I don't mind if other people read it too, because it's we can break up the reading a bit, but it's not easy to read aloud. It's beautiful, but your mouth gets twisted around the words easily.
I read that it was the one of the I think it might have been the first maybe one of the first epics maybe around well no because the Odyssey and the Iliad are don't rhyme and are they blank verse? I don't know. I always confuse blank versus free verse. But
They're not rhymed, you're right, the Odyssey. But I mean, of course they were written in Greek and translated in English. This is written in English from
maybe it
the
was the first English epic to not rhyme.
yeah, I think it's probably the
Yeah.
first English.
But
Although
yeah.
Chaucer's work is not doesn't have any epics, but I mean the Canterbury Tales is like an epic. It's huge, right? So
I read somewhere where it was talking about how because I don't know if you guys read the I didn't get to read the whole book, but one of the there was an interesting this sort of introductory paragraph called the verse that Milton wrote before the
Yeah,
actual.
well, I was going to read that aloud before each section. I was going to read his version.
Yeah. It's cool what he says about, he said something about rhyme, like, it was really cool. He was like, the first in English, he associates not rhyming with, like, bondage. Bondage is associated with rhyming, and liberty is associated with not rhyming. Which is super interesting. Like, I really like that. I don't know. Yeah.
Mm.
And the other thing that I was reading was talking about how, like, his actual rhythmic, the rhythm of his lines, which is one way of saying, like, the rhythm of his syntax, is quite unique. Like, I think most people in, who are writing poetry in English around them are writing rhyming poems with somewhat similar rhythms in terms of the lines and syntax. But Milton's syntax is super intricate and, like, it has its own kind of music, I think. So it's something to, you know, interesting to think about.
Hi, John.
Good morning. Hi.
How are you this morning?
Good, thank you.
No storms there? You had a storm yesterday, didn't you?
Yesterday. It's not too bad today.
Because they announced storms here, but we haven't seen anything yet. It sort of drizzled yesterday, and that was it.
We've had lots of rain, actually. Heat and rain.
So is this, maybe this is it for today, because I think Marco is tied up with something else, right? So, if we had any kind of, because well, let's just do a check-in and see whether there are any leftover issues. I mean, we've had some discussion on the forum. I must admit, I did read them through this morning, but a lot of it went by while I was busy in the week. So I think we're getting more cross connections, maybe with some other. So the critics, maybe you'll be able to talk to that a bit, Andrew. Is it Epson or Empson? I guess Empson. And so we can talk a little bit about the critical readings as well. But let's just check in first.
Well, I'm going to start with my metaphor for reading this. For this reading of Milton's Paradise Lost, to be useful, this reading will be like an excavation of an archaeological site hidden, that's been hidden somewhere in a jungle. And for this reading to be like an excavation, I will have to be like a archaeologist with some good colleagues and lots of stamina to withstand the intensity of this descent. And it's could be quite dangerous because you don't know what's down there. And patience to detect what are the objects that need to be isolated and removed carefully, so that later all these objects that might be discovered can be arranged relationally so that we can discover what the logic might be. Anyway, that's my metaphor for reading this particular text. If anyone else has a metaphor they want to share, I would love to hear what that could be. It's just helpful for me to start entering into the weave of this text symbolically. And to reconnect And it, to me, it's like moving into a breath-based consciousness rather than a head-based consciousness. Because it seems like these creatures are like floating in this very strange medium. And it feels very weird and ungrounded when I'm reading this text, because I don't know where they are exactly. Anyway, that's my first spin. So I'm looking forward to hearing what everyone else is up to. Thanks.
Thanks, John. That was a lovely imagery about the process of digging into Milton. And I guess the breathing has to do with the oral. So the reading aloud, I think, is also a very interesting way to ground the text. I wanted to say that I'm feeling a little bit of trepidation because, you know, on paper, I'm the one who's leading the discussion. I feel a certain responsibility that way. And I feel out of my depth. I mean, typical, you know, I take on these jobs of leading these discussions. And it really, you know, I mean, I read Milton years ago, but it's such a big text. And it has such a lot of influence on the whole development of modern civilization. You know, who am I to be leading a discussion about Milton's Paradise Lost or the other text that we're talking about, the other writers that we're talking about? So I know I'm not, it's not just me, so I have some good company, which I'm going to rely on to take us forward on this exercise. So I am feeling, so I don't have a metaphor per se, but although I will think about that. But
you don't have to. It's just an exercise for me. If anyone finds it useful, that would be cool. Or any other way you want to approach this is fine with me.
So I'll go next. And yeah, my metaphor is not present, but I remember Marco saying he was like a bee alighting on various readings and flowering text or whatever. But I feel over the past couple of months, I've really been honing in on the ability to read. It's almost like a speed reading in a way, but I'm absorbing text better than I had in the past. Perhaps because of Andrew and his proliferation and just the amount of things that are being presented with quantum social theory, poetry now, and Gebser, the axial age, all these things are just beyond what I can articulate, but I'm absorbing so much or alighting on all these different topics. And as mentioned, I have zero background with Milton. I did check out a biography, which doesn't seem to be the best biography in the world, but it's taking his, calls him an author, David Hawkes calls him a hero of our time, and he's taking kind of the postmodern look. And so extracting Milton's place and time and placing it into the current, how it's relevant today, which is perhaps useful in a certain sense. I don't know if it'll, but he does do a good job of tapping into, I think, where Milton was coming from, at least for me. So it's a good beginner's book. But he quoted Milton with, he really wanted to, he said, the B is spelled B-E-E in Old English, or whatever English is called at this time, but he said, man ought himself to be a true poem. So I'm imagining Milton, that's something that resonates with me, is wanting to not necessarily write or do this or that, but to live my life as true as possible, to be this highest truth, which poetry seems to be the encapsulation of what is true, the closest we can get to perhaps the unspeakable. So there's that for your metaphor. I guess I'm a bee that's trying to stay still.
You're a bee that's trying to stay still. So for this reading to be useful for you, you will be a bee that is trying to stand still. And for this reading to be like a bee that stands still, you will be like what?
I don't know if bees can hear, but I'll be a listening bee. All right. I'll listen at my best here.
Thank you.
That's all I need to say. Thanks, guys.
As opposed to a spelling bee.
Listening bee.
I guess I should say something now. In terms of the metaphor,
well, where would you like to start, Andrew? If you don't want to start with the metaphor,
I don't know if I would use the word metaphor, but I guess I do have a sort of way of framing how I am thinking about the text, The Paradise Lost.
Great.
And it's kind of like this, like there's like a, but there's a word and a title and a term that has accrued much meaning over time through history and culture. And that two-word term is like Paradise Lost. And like, you can invoke that term in many different contexts, and the invocation of that term will trigger or elicit many different thoughts and feelings about this canonical text called Paradise Lost. And that's really interesting in and of itself. But if we really think about like, well, what's one way of framing this text? Well, I think I really like how Doug's biographical take, or at least his interest in Milton's biography, because I think biographical information is always interesting in terms of helping us think about texts. It's not the be all end all, but it's a good way to start. And when I was learning recently about Milton, you know, there are a lot of aspects of his life preceding the writing of Paradise Lost. I don't even know if you would actually say writing. You maybe might want to say dictating, because I don't think he actually wrote it. I mean, he was blind when he like spoke it aloud to someone who wrote his thoughts down. But he clearly had an absolutely fascinating, you know, active life, politically, poetically, philosophically, religiously, and all of that, like, let, and you could say, if you want to talk about teleologically, like, led to him being an old man, sort of on the margins of society at that point, I think, being blind, and writing, I mean, not writing, but, like, dictating this text that is, like, I would say I want to frame it as like essentially a vision, but it's not a vision. It's a diachronic vision. It's a vision that is structured and flows through time. It's not like a sudden illumination. It's like a totally elaborated upon or articulated vision, but it is essentially a vision. I mean, like it was a vision of his imagination. You know, and that's how I think it's useful to think about it. Like, it was every single thing he had ever thought and felt, you know, like for when he was in his 20s and 30s, for 6 years, he just like studied. Like, he just studied for 6 years. He was like probably one of the most learned poets in Western civilization. But it was like everything he had thought and felt and experienced was like somehow poured into this vision of Paradise Lost. And if you actually think about it like phenomenologically, like when he dictated it, well, you can ask yourself like, well, like what was actually happening when Milton, who was old and blind, like drew upon his inner resources and articulated this, what became to be called Paradise Lost. And I think it's a vision in his, of his imagination. You know, it's in And the vision is like syncretic. You know, it draws upon all these various sources and ideas and images. But at the same time, it's very idiosyncratic. You know, like Milton was really, you could argue, like a Miltonist before the Miltonists. Like, I don't know if you can really, he doesn't really fit into any camps. I'm sure like many people would argue that he was like a Whig, maybe, you know, Whig or a Protestant, or, you know, I don't know as much about the politics. And I'm sure in some ways, yes, but like ultimately, I think Milton is Milton, and he doesn't really fit within, he's so unique and he's so idiosyncratic and he's so visionary. He doesn't really fit within our typical frameworks. And I think Paradise Lost is a great instantiation of that he's of his sort of idiosyncrasy and his vision. Yeah. And is another good word for him is heterodox. And maybe even heretical. I don't know. Yeah.
Thank you. So that's a nice framing for the project of reading Paradise Lost. I don't really have a full summary of the whole set of books, but I obviously when we talk about Paradise Lost, we're talking about the fall of Adam and Eve, even though it starts with Lucifer, right? So the first two books describe Lucifer's, well, the fall, the arrival in hell, the fall as the arrival in hell, and the discussion among the different fallen angels about what to do next. And then they decide that they're going to wage a kind of guerrilla war against God by going to Earth and fouling up things for the new formed human species. So book three is Lucifer moving to Eden, and in book four he arrives, and so there's a lot of discussion about I think it's book three is we have the perspective of God looking down on these events, and in books 5, 6, and 7 we have a kind of recapitulation of the fall, of the battle and the fall of the angels after, you know, so and then it's only in the fourth sort of final set of books that we actually have the conversations between Lucifer and Eve and Adam, and then the sort of tree of good and evil and all those things, right? Until, so at the very end of the book, Adam and Eve are led out of the Garden of Eden. So this is the kind of, so the structure of Paradise Lost. It's very like a film in a way, because a film will start bang smack in the middle of the action. You know, I mean, the films learned it from Milton in a way, because obviously he was one of the first people who did things this way. Canterbury Tales doesn't start that way at all. Canterbury Tales, you know, tells you all about the pilgrimage and all the people, and you don't actually get into the action until somewhat further in. But Milton, you're right in the middle of the fall of the Lucifer at the beginning. Then you have the move towards Eden, and then you start to recapitulate what happened, how Lucifer got there and the battle in heaven and how that all happened. And only then, when you've done that, do you get the actual exchange with Adam and Eve. And so it's a very kind of cinematic experience, the way Milton lays it out. Yeah, so I don't have a lot more than that. Yeah, go ahead, John.
I'd like to do something, an exercise. I need some support for this. It just came to me as I was listening to the different commentaries, including my own, and the cinematic nature of this text. Of course, Milton did not have access to cinema, and he was also blind. So what were the senses that he was using? I think if everyone could just sit up as straight as you can in your chair, if you're sitting, I want you to extend your arms. Your hands are down. I want you to flap them like wings. And I want you to coordinate this with a breath. Breathe all the way in through your nose and do the breath of fire. Do we know how to do the breath of fire? It's a yoga. It's got... So you're breathing an inhale and exhale very quickly on a full, fill up your lungs full of air while you beat your arms up and down. So try to coordinate the breathing with the movement. If you run out of breath, just take another deep breath and keep going. We're going to go for another minute. And I really want you to enjoy it. Almost there. Okay, and just relax. Just feel the energy flowing through your body. And now I want you to work with the root center. And I want you to use the L-U-N-G, loom. So you're going to work with the L, and you're going to feel the floor of your pelvis vibrate it with that sound. So it goes, and you're going to take a deep breath in and exhale on the loom sound and vibrate your anus. Can everyone unmute? Can you unmute, Doug? Could you unmute, Andrew? I want to hear your voices. Okay. We're in hell. This is hell. One more time. Okay, now we're descending into hell. This is a free-form chant. You're all fallen angels. I want you to make sounds, but breathe in, connect to the body and the subtle body, and close your eyes. Okay, we're going to do a free-form chant as we descend into hell. Okay, and we'll do it. And I have a chime here. So I will... Actually, maybe we should just do this now. Let it be a free-form chant, so it won't have any structure. Okay. So when you're ready, breathe all the way in, connect to the body, and you're descending into hell. And you can close your eyes if you like, so you can get more into I think, Milton's world. Are you all with me?
Hey, but what are we going to be chanting? Sorry.
It's a free-form chant. You can use that L sound if you like. You can use other sounds. You can also use E. That's sort of in your head. That's coming sort of from your pelvis. You can play around with different sounds. Okay. And really, it's all about the breath. And when you're ready. So maybe we should start with the argument.
Okay.
Or is there something that you're especially drawn to in this text? Or is there something that has been invoked by this exercise? I want to keep it present. I don't want to go into theory land, although theory is useful and important. I would like to stay with the text.
Well, would somebody like to read the argument? I can do it.
Please.
Okay. This first book proposes, first in brief, the whole subject, man's disobedience and the loss thereupon of paradise wherein he was placed. Then touches the prime cause of his fall, the serpent, or rather Satan in the serpent, who revolted from God, and drawing to his side many legions of angels, was by the command of God driven out of heaven with all his crew into the great deep. Which action passed over? The poem hastes into the midst of things, presenting Satan with his angels, now fallen into hell, described here, not in the center, for heaven and earth may be supposed as yet not made, certainly not yet accursed, but in a place of utter darkness, Phitlius called chaos. Here, Satan with his angels, lying on the burning lake, thunderstruck and astonished, after a certain space recovers, as from confusion, calls up him who next in order and dignity lay by him. They confer of their miserable fall. Satan awakens all his legions, who lay till then in the same manner confounded. They rise, their numbers, array of battle, their chief leaders named, according to the idols known afterwards in Canaan and the countries adjoining. To these, Satan directs his speech, comforts them with hope yet of regaining heaven, but tells them lastly of a new world, a new kind of creature to be created, according to an ancient prophecy or report in heaven, For that angels were long before this visible creation was the opinion of many ancient fathers. To find out the truth of this prophecy and what to determine thereon, he refers to a full council, what his associates thence attempt. Pandemonium, the palace of Satan, rises, suddenly built out of the deep. The infernal peers there sit in council.
So we are the infernal peers.
Right.
And we're in council, and we have just descended from heaven to hell.
Yes.
So how does that make you feel? And I think this is the narrator. I don't know who the narrative voice begins. I think it's sort of connected to the voice of that's making this argument. But I would love to hear one of the beautiful baritone voices here start the verse. Anyone want to volunteer for this? That was beautiful, by the way, Jeffrey. Thank you. Andrew? Doug?
Strobo, Henry.
What?
I'm audible?
Yeah, I hear you.
Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world. And all our woe, with loss of Eden, till one greater man restores us and regain the blissful seat. Seeing heavenly muse, that on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai, didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen sea. In the beginning, how the heavens and earth rose out of chaos. Or a Sion hill delight thee more, and Siloah's brook that flowed fast by the oracle of God, I thence invoke thy aid to my adventurous song, that with no middle flight intends to soar above the Aeonian mount, while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. And chiefly thou, O Spirit, that dost prefer before all temples the upright heart and pure, instruct me, for thou knowest, thou from the first wast present, and with my wings outspread, dove-like, saddest brooding on the vast abyss, and maddest its pregnant. What in me is dark, illumine, what is low, raise and support, that to the height of this great argument, I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men.
Can I ask a question? Who are you?
I'm in the darkness and I don't know who I am right now.
Thank you.
But I'm participating. I'm a participant in this
Thank
plan.
You.
Council.
Do you want to continue, or would someone else like to continue the next paragraph? It's a long one. It takes a lot of stamina.
I'll read a little bit.
Okay.
I don't know how far to go, but we'll go real. Okay. All right. Say first, for heaven hides nothing from thy view, thy being the spirit, I guess. Say first, for heaven hides nothing from thy view, nor the deep trapped of hell. Say first, what cause moved our grandparents in that happy state, favored of heaven so highly, to fall off from their creator and transgress his will, for one restraint, lords of the world besides? Who first seduced them to that foul revolt? The infernal serpent, he it was, whose guile stirred up with envy and revenge, deceived the mother of mankind. What time his pride had cast him out from heaven, with all his host of rebel angels, by whose aid, aspiring to set himself in glory above his peers, he trusted to have equaled the Most High, if he opposed, and with ambitious aim against the throne and monarchy of God, raised impious war in heaven and battle proud with vain attempt. Him, the almighty power, hurled headlong flaming from the ethereal sky with hideous ruin and combustion down to bottomless perdition, there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire, who durst defy the omnipotent to arms. 9 times the space that measures day and night to mortal men, he with his horrid crew lay vanquished, rolling in the fiery gulf, confounded though immortal. But his doom reserved him to more wrath, for now the thought both of lost happiness and lasting pain torments him. Round he throws his baleful eyes that witnessed huge affliction and dismay mixed with obdurate pride and steadfast hate. At once, as far as angels can, he views the dismal situation, waste and wild, a dungeon horrible, on all sides round, as one great furnace flamed. Yet from those flames no light, but rather darkness visible. It's a really famous
song. Keep going. I'm going to make a few sounds.
Only discover sights of woe, regions of sorrow, doleful shades where peace and rest can never dwell. Never comes that comes to all. Torture without end urges in a fiery deluge fed with ever-burning sulfur unconsumed. Such place eternal justice had prepared for those rebellious. Here, their prison ordained in utter darkness, and their portion set as far removed from God and light of heaven as from the center thrice to the utmost pole. Oh, how unlike the place from whence they fell. There the companions of his fall, overwhelmed with floods and whirlwinds of tempestuous fire, he soon discerns, and weltering by his side, one next to himself in power, and next in crime, long after known in Palestine, and named Beelzebub, to whom the arch-enemy, and thence in heaven called Satan, with bold words, breaking the horrid silence, thus began.
Okay, I'm going to go with this one. If thou beest he, but oh, how fallen, how changed from him, who in the happy realms of light, clothed with transcendent brightness, didst outshine myriads, though bright. If he whom mutual league, united thoughts and counsels, equal hope and hazard in the glorious enterprise, joined with me, now misery hath joined in equal ruin, into what pit thou seest, from what height fallen, so much the stronger proved he with his thunder. Until then, who knew the force of those dire arms? Yet not for those, nor what the potent victor in his rage can else inflict, do I repent or change, though changed in outward bluster, that fixed mind, and high disdain from sense of injured merit, that with the mightiest raised me to contend, and to the fierce contention brought along innumerable force of spirits armed, that durst dislike his reign, and me preferring he utmost power with adverse power, opposed in dubious battle on the plains of heaven, and shook his throne. What though the field be lost, all is not lost. The unconquerable will and study of revenge, immortal hate and courage never to submit or yield. And what is else not to be overcome? That glory never shall his wrath or might extort from me. To bow and sue for grace with suppliant knee and deify his power, who from the terror of this arm so late doubted his empire, that were low indeed, that were an ignominy and shame beneath this downfall. Since by fate the strength of gods and this imperial substance cannot fail, since through experience of this great event in arms not worse and foresight much advanced, we may with more successful hope resolve to wage by force or guile eternal war irreconcilable to our grand foe, who now triumphs and in the excess of joy so reigning holds the tyranny of heaven. So spake the apostate angel, though in pain, vaunting aloud, but racked with deep despair. And him thus answered, soon his bold compeer. There's another fallen angel he's in dialogue with. Someone want to rehearse that one?
Hang on, I'll go with it. So spake the apostate angel, though in pain, vaunting aloud, but racked with deep despair, and him thus answered soon his bold compeer. O prince, O chief of many throned powers, that led the embattled seraphim to war under thy conduct, and in dreadful deeds fearless, endangered heaven's perpetual king, and put to proof his high supremacy, whether upheld by strength or chance or fate, too well I see and rue the dire event that with sad overthrow and foul defeat hath lost us heaven, and all this mighty host in horrible destruction laid thus low, as far as gods and heavenly essences can perish, for the mind and spirit remains invincible, and vigor soon returns, though all our glory extinct and happy state here swallowed up in endless misery. But what if he, our conqueror, whom I now of force believe almighty, since no less than such could have overpowered such force as ours, have left us this our spirit and strength entire, strongly to suffer and support our pains, that we may so suffice his vengeful ire, or do him mightier service as his thralls by right of war? Whate'er this business be here in the heart of hell to work in fire, or do his errands in the gloomy deep, what can it then avail, though yet we feel strength undiminished, or eternal being to undergo eternal punishment? Whereto with speedy words the archfiend replied,
I'll continue. Fallen cherub, to be weak is miserable, doing or suffering, but of this be sure, to do aught good never will be our task, but ever to do ill our sole delight, as being the contrary to his high will whom we resist. If then his providence out of our evil seek to bring forth good, our labor must be to pervert that end, and out of good still to find means of evil, which oft times may succeed, or as perhaps shall grieve him, if I fail not, and disturb his inmost counsels from their destined aim. But see, the angry victor hath recalled his ministers of vengeance and pursuit back to the gates of heaven. The sulphurous hail shot after us in storm, or blown hath laid the fiery surge that from the precipice of heaven received us falling, and the thunder, winged with red lightning and impetuous rage, perhaps hath spent his shafts, and ceases now to bellow through the vast and boundless deep. Let us not slip the occasion where, whether scorn or satiate fury yielded from our foe. Seest thou yon dreary plain forlorn and wild, the seat of desolation, void of light, save what the glimmering of these livid flames casts pale and dreadful. Thither let us tend from off the tossing of these fiery waves, there rest, if any rest can harbor there, and reassembling our afflicted powers, consult how we may henceforth most offend our enemy, our own loss how repair, how overcome this dire calamity, with what reinforcements we may gain from hope, if not what resolution from despair. So should we take a pause?
Yeah, I think we should take a pause. It kind of, I find reading it even on my own, I have to stop actually more frequently than that in order to just assimilate what's going on. Yeah.
Well, it's an opera. It's like a 4-hour Wagnerian opera. And you know, they say that the singers who play the leads in like Tristan and Isolde lose 10 pounds every performance. It's stamina that's required to play these roles. And I'm treating this as theater. And I think Milton did as well. But I've learned a lot from this reading so far. And I've also, I feel like there's a lot of energy. And it's not about doing it right. You know, I'm taking huge leaps here. And I think that each of us can bring to the text whatever we want, but we all have everything we need right now, today. We have everything we need to read this really well. And it's great to know that other people have read this really well, and we can check out what they've read, studied, and bring that to this rehearsal performance space. So I'm very curious about you guys, what you may have learned from this rehearsal so far. Thanks.
I'll state that another book I've been reading is The Gutenberg Galaxy, which, and the part I'm at right now is talking about the difference between actually listening to the speaker in olden times. I'm not familiar with the history, so I'm going to flub it up a bit, but basically everything was dictated, everything was heard and presented. The visual was not needed to preserve the text, and I really appreciate this reading aloud as we kind of stumble along at the beginning here. I think as we move along later on, we'll jump into the text a little bit more. When I was reading this on the page visually, it didn't do too much for me, especially with no background other than, well, maybe this is Satan talking or some minions. I couldn't read it and get what needed to be gotten. But hearing it is a whole different story. So I appreciate this effort that we're doing here. And the pre-work that you led us through, John, is awkward for perhaps me and others. But as we get out of that mode of awkwardness, I'm in a library, and I know next to the room there's another individual, so they might peek in later on to check if I'm okay if I start groaning again. But I greatly appreciate reading aloud, and I'm hoping that someday I'll be able to memorize chunks of, if not this text, but other texts, so I can do this in the shower or wherever. So thank you.
Yeah, that's good to know. You're in a library and you have to be quiet. I appreciate that. So, but yeah, I feel your energy coming through, even with those constraints. Thank you.
I also had an interesting, possibly awkward experience, which is that I'm sitting like in this part of my apartment that's more of like a sunroom, which I really like, even though it's not really furnished, except for this chair where I'm sitting. But right next to me is another house, and it's being painted, and there's like a ladder, and the painter was working, and I wondered if he could hear me going, "Lo." I don't know. I think one thing to think about in terms of like what we just read, and then also in the larger sense of Paradise Lost, is I don't know the word for it. The word that came to me while we were reading is that there's like a certain like deliciousness of the language. Like Milton is utterly in love with what he's speaking. And I guess you could say he's savoring it. I don't know. He's like luxuriating in his knowledge and imagination and vocabulary and how it's all fusing together into this poem. And I think when we read the poem or hear it, we should resonate or try to resonate with how delicious it is. And in that sense, we might even, I mean, maybe we can talk about this in whenever, but like clearly there are various interpretations about how we should, and we talked about this in the thread, about how we should approach Satan. And these are very sometimes incompatible and incommensurable interpretations, and they're worth thinking about. I mean, and I think personally, I think really one of the reasons why I think that Milton was of Satan's party is because the language is so delicious when we are hearing Satan speak or hearing Satan described. I mean, I don't know what else to say, I guess. Like, and I feel like when critics seem to argue that Satan is like some sort of, I don't know, like religious devil or whatever, I feel like they're not really picking up on like the sheer joy of the language, the sheer delight of reading about, of reading Satan's like soliloquies or whatever, which are just like purely fun and like fascinating and delicious. So that's something to think about, you know.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree that the language, it's not just that it's delicious, but it has, I mean, it came out in the readings. It has such a rhythm and such a power and energy that just comes bursting out, right, of the reading, of the way it's presented to us. It's interesting what you say about the deliciousness, because he uses words like, you know, miserable and the sort of, you know, monstrous to describe. I mean, because there's a separation between the narrator, who one is presumes is Milton in a way, and the characters that he portrays. So when he's talking, Milton's talking, he describes them as monstrous. But when they talk, they don't say we're monstrous. They say we're wonderful, right? And so you have this slight disconnect between the kind of slightly judgmental language that he uses as a narrator compared to the way these characters move and describe and speak to each other. But of course, it's Milton writing all these pieces. So that's why, even though he's... So I think that may be partly why there's a little bit of confusion in the literature, is because people, you know, sort of jump to this idea that the narrator is judgmental. And therefore, the whole text is judgmental. But of course, it's not that simple, because you can't write this gorgeous prose about Lucifer and Satan and the devils and Beelzebub and all the rest of it. You know, it's like one of the great lessons I remember learning in when I was in studying English literature, and we looked at some of Jonathan Swift's work, right? So Gulliver's Travels but also A Modest Proposal, the one, and these kinds of things, is you can't write satire about something unless you love it. Satire only works if the author compellingly delivers the thing that he's arguing against. And in order to compellingly deliver it, you have to get into it, inside it. And for that, you have to like it to some extent.
Yes,
even though it's kind of paradoxical.
I think you have to
love A Modest Proposal. I mean, a modest proposal is very difficult that way because it's an argument against child exploitation in Ireland. And you know, but the argument is it's presented as an argument that we should eat these children, right? So it's a very sort of difficult and negative, very biting satire. But to some extent, to get into this argument, he had to have embraced the position of those who are exploiting the children. It's satire is difficult that way. And Milton's, although it's not satire, it has some of those same properties where he gets into you know, so, you know, you can understand why Blake argued that Milton was in Satan's on Satan's side in this text, because it's hard to argue anything else when you read it.
can I add something to those comments?
Please.
I think it's interesting that Jeffrey, that you just invoked or mentioned satire, even though, of course, Paradise Lost isn't a satire. But I think, I don't know if this is why, what made you think of it, but I was also wondering why sometimes when I was reading Paradise Lost or hear it spoken, I kind of like laugh. Like I have like actual like laughter that comes up. And like, why does that happen? And I think honestly, like, I don't know what you guys think, but like, there's a really famous book by, I think, a critic named maybe Christopher Ricks. And it's about Keats. Keats was a famous romantic poet. And it's about Keats. So Keats came after Milton. Keats was a romantic poet who wrote in the 19th century. The book is about Keats and embarrassment. Like, so what does that mean? I don't know. I guess I feel like it's almost embarrassing how pure Milton's vision is, that it's like almost funny. Like it's not ironic. Like we live in an age that is like suffused with irony. I mean, it's a common place to even say that, but like Milton is not ironic.
Yeah. He's like, not joking here.
He's not fucking around. Yeah. And he's like, and his heart is pure. Like whatever, however you want to take that. Like when he invokes, I keep saying invokes, when he mentions at the beginning of the poem about the purity of hearts, like I feel like he really means that like ontologically. Like he's not just like saying this as a trope. Like I don't think Milton would have been able to write Paradise Lost if he didn't actually himself have like a pure heart in some sense. So in a way, it's funny because it's like, I don't know, it's kind of embarrassing. It's like, good God, this guy's like amazing. It's, I don't know how to put it really, but so I was trying to figure out why when I read like texts like this, I kind of laugh. I'm like, what's it's not really funny, you know, but yeah.
I think what I learned in the reading was the delicious language and the pleasure it gives you. And that moving, as you said, Jeffrey, from the narrator to the character and the different qualities as you go from a description of these evil characters from the outside to the inside, and you find the motivations and the aspirations of Beelzebub and his cohorts. That they are, I believe, driven by beauty. And there's a strong utopianism operating here. And I think that it's gotten inverted because of this horrific trauma that has just occurred. I don't think any of them had any idea that this was going to be the outcome of their actions. And I think they've been shocked by the immense power of their adversary to just annihilate them. And that they had served in heaven. But I think that now that they're in hell and they've been thrown to the outer limit, I think they don't have anything to lose. And I think this is what I found. But I found what I enjoyed about the reading was the rhythm, and that we were catching the rhythm. And I felt it especially when Jeffrey started to play the other angel, the other fallen angel. About halfway through the speech, I heard Jeffrey catch the rhythm. Before that, it was a little, I felt he was a little outside. He wasn't quite inside. But when he got inside, I think it was when he felt the rhythm. And it had a kind of, each line had an energy that moved to the next line and the next line and the next line, so that the energy is sustained. And I think it's about, much more about catching the rhythm. And I hope we can continue that as we continue to think about this text, mm-hmm. and as we rehearse it, and, you know, in the privacy of our library, and as we bring it into like a public space like here. And also, just to go into a little bit of the theory and the history, we know that Milton was, he was in the Civil War. He was involved in it. He worked, I believe, for Cromwell, who deposed Charles I, I believe, and they beheaded him. They beheaded the king. 10 years later, William Cromwell is deposed. There was, by the way, this all happened at the end of a big civil war. The civil war created opportunities for people who had never had any power to speak publicly. And there's a very moving document. It's online somewhere, where you hear a council of the aristocrats and the peasants that joined with the aristocrats to overthrow the English king. And there was some despair when the peasants who had worked so hard to make this happen were not given a voice at the table about how the government was going to be run. And there's a beautiful text, I have to find it, historical, where you hear, probably for the first time, you hear a peasant talking to the aristocrats about this injustice, that, you know, they are the ones who made this battle successful, and they want to be at the table to determine their own future. And I believe that this is something that was not reported widely or distributed widely, because, you know, peasants didn't read or write. And I think this is one of the moments in where that unspoken experience had a voice. And I think Milton was very much one of the aristocrats. But I think they lost ultimately. Charles II came back, was restored, and there was a shutdown. They had to shut it all down. And I believe Cromwell, Cromwell wasn't executed, but he had already died. Cromwell had died. And there was nothing to, the government wasn't strong enough to hold it together without a monarch. So the monarch was brought back, but they had Cromwell, his body dug up, and they cut off his head and put it on a pike and put it on top of the tower. So this was highly symbolic. So this is when Milton, who was one of the rebels, who was in the government with Cromwell, and now his party has been defeated and is out of power, and he's a blind old man. How is he going to, where is he writing from? Where is this coming from? And what are the constraints that he is under? If you imagine you're in a library and you don't want to disturb your neighbors by your loud voice, what do you think, who are the people he was going to disturb if he said the wrong thing? They could easily come and take off his head, just as the way they had dug up Cromwell's corpse and decapitated it. So it's a miracle, actually, that this text ever was created with those kind of constraints, the political constraints. So I think that's where he's coming from, the mixed messages and the that we hear in these complex arguments that are being offered. And I think it's a Gnostic voice. I know some of us are talking about Gnosticism, but it's sort of like the whole idea of Gnosticism is that we don't know God directly. We do know God directly. And the powers that are running this earth are not God. So I think it's this, so there's a, in Gnosticism, these are voices that have not been heard or expressed. And I think that they come in very strange sizes and shapes. And some of those Gnostic texts we found in the Nag Hammadi desert, we're still looking at them. They're very perplexing to us because the official church had them suppressed and the and Gnostic voices were erupting all the time. Like the Cathars in southern France were a persecuted sect that the Catholic Church destroyed brutally and burned them at the stake. And these are basically, the Cathars were a resurgence of these Gnostic voices. I think you could trace them all the way back to the those texts in the desert that they discovered. So I think that, I don't know how much of that Milton had access to, that history that I just described with the Nag Hammadi, but I do think the voices that are unleashed in this text are Gnostic voices. So anyway, that's my spiel, and I have to think more about that. I'll try to find the link to the some of this historical background of the Civil War, and I think some of the resonances. And I think I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I think it's good to know something about the history and the biography of the poet. And then we have to somehow drop all that when we read it, just so we can catch the rhythm. And then we can go back and forth. And I think when we go back to reading it, we may be better informed. We can catch the rhythm even better than before. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Johnny, for that interesting take on the history of the thing. So, you know, the Cromwell Revolution was 100 years before the French Revolution, which is considered to be the marking break with royalty. And of course, the English started this process more than a century before the French did. And in some ways, the French Revolution was built off of ideas that were raised in the Cromwell resurrection, right? So, and the other thing I wanted to point out that is that even though Cromwell's was a rebellion of power of the king versus the people, it was also kind of framed in religious terms, because in these days, religion and the power politics were all intertwined, which is why Paradise Lost can't be read as only a religious text, because the religion and the power politics interconnect, right? So, the other thing I wanted to say is Milton wrote a text called Areopagita, which is also an interesting text because it is one of the first arguments in favor of equality of women in society. So this was before anybody was writing, except maybe, you know, a few little, I think Chaucer had a little bit, I think the Wife of Bath in the Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is kind of a pre-feminist figure, and Chaucer predates Milton. But Milton's is actually an argument for the equality of women. So a political argument, it's like a tract, like a political tract, Areopagita, and not a poem or something else. So, because he did write some of these essays, kind of.
Well, this is interesting, Jeffrey. So I'm sort of drawing upon the conversation that we had yesterday, when we talked about I talked about querying the Bible, how we could go back and through literature, and we could look at something that was latent in the culture that may not have been fully expressed or may have been interrupted and suppressed, but that latent energetic has been expressed since then in various forms, different social movements. So as a gay man, you know, they told me very young, you don't have a history. and you're a deviant. Because we say so. We're the authorities. And there were enough of us that I believe we resonated to the public domain in different ways. And I remember very consciously identifying with Satan. I did not know why. I found him so compelling. And also David and Jonathan in the Bible, there was a resonance there. And so I believe there were enough scholars, which I'm not a scholar by any means, but I just read a lot, but I've read enough people who have, gay studies, came online, and you can get a degree in it, and it has a lot, and queering, and queer theory is about this. It's about how do we go back into history and read it through the prism of those who lost or were defeated or who were not heard, since we all know that, you know, history is written by the winners. And I think this is maybe some call it postmodern, I would call it late modern, but I think there's a healthy forms of it that we should encourage. But I think that I sense that as you were talking about the French Revolution and the influence that the Civil War and the beheading of Charles I, that had an impact on the French. And of course, what happened in France had a huge impact on the rest of Europe. And we know the monarchy pretty much ended just about everywhere shortly after that, except for the propped up monarchy that we still see in Britain. And I think the Netherlands has a similar arrangement. But anyway, I think that's interesting. I think that's interesting. Although we can't say, Milton would not have known these results. But I think that we, as modern, postmodern, integralist thinkers, can resonate with what was latent in the living arrangements that he was drawing upon in his particular historical chronology. And I hope that's making some sense, because I think that's a very interesting way of reading it. And also, he, like I mentioned earlier, you're talking about how cinematic he was. Of course, he never saw a movie. But I think he set the stage, in a way, for the imagination of a lot of cinematic thinking. And I think these influences are probably extremely indirect. But I think we all have everything we need to read this text already. Because I think it's Milton is in our bones. Even if you've never read him, he has shaped your life. It's just as if you've never read Shakespeare. Believe me, the language you speak today is totally based upon the foundation that Shakespeare laid. So I think that's very intriguing that there's a kind of a resonance that we may not be in touch with or are very particularly clear about, but we can tap into it very quickly, because these are incredibly archetypal forces. You know, this rebel is very deep in our psyche. And ever since we've been 2 years old, that terrible two, you know, it's part of our development. If we don't have that adequate expression at an early age, we don't function very well as adults. So I think that's something we should consider too. Thanks.
So there's another thing that I wanted to bring back from the text. At one point, Satan is talking about God, and he ascribes to God all of the malefic feelings that the fallen angels have between them, right? So it's this inversion of the role of God in the text, which is really interesting, because it's sort of suggesting, well, God waged this war against the fallen angels out of spite, right? So this is an unusual argument to put in God's mouth. I mean, clearly it's done through the fallen angels, but it casts doubt in some sense on the motives of God, right, in this context. It's probably the first text in world literature that does cast doubt on the the aspirations and ideas that God has. Obviously, it's the fallen angels, and they have their own reasons for bringing up these arguments. But nevertheless, once the argument is out on paper, it's there, you know. So, and I think that argument also shatters Al Molinier, as you mentioned. It's Andrew. It's an ironic age, and that's nourishment of irony is that kind of an argument, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, I guess even though, yeah, it is definitely, I guess, I don't know if I would say, well, and it's important to think about irony, because like clearly, even though we do live in ironic age, it might be a certain interpretation of irony. I mean, clearly irony exists in Shakespeare and I'm sure in Milton, I mean, definitely Milton and Chaucer and whatever else. So maybe it's a certain way of thinking about irony that's current art. But anyways, but I want to point out that even though we all seem to be agreeing that that Milton was of the Satan's party, or whatever, like I don't know if that is actually. I don't know if most people read. I don't know. I don't really know. I'd be curious to know if most people read Paradise Lost that way. But like I have a good friend who I knew when I was in the PhD program, and. And she loves C.S. Lewis, and C.S. Lewis is sort of like the figure used as the stand-in for like the Christian humanist interpretation of Paradise Lost, which sees Satan totally, utterly different from the way we're talking about him. And are you guys familiar with C.S. Lewis?
Yeah.
Okay. So I emailed her actually, when I was reading Paradise Lost and coming across like Blake's interpretation and Bloom's interpretation and Shelley's interpretation. Shelley is, one of the canonical romantic poets, you know, like Keats, the other. And the way we're talking about Satan is often characterized as like the Blake and Shelley view. And probably Bloom too, and maybe Empson, William Empson. And it's really informed by romanticism, since Blake and Shelley were romantic poets. So all this was, I was thinking about, and so I reached out to my friend to find out like how she viewed this whole thing, since I was like, wow, that's pretty interesting, because we clearly aren't reading the same text. If she does agree with C.S. Lewis's interpretation, which essentially argues that Satan is like the devil incarnate, like in reality, and represents like spiritual warfare, like the demonological or whatever you want to say. And like, that's very different from what we're talking about Paradise Lost. I mean, clearly. So anyway, so I wrote her and we had an email exchange and it was super interesting and edifying. And she really does mostly agree with C.S. Lewis. And I'm sure there are plenty of other people who do too. I mean, like C.S. Lewis sells millions of books. But she had an interesting, she sort of said some interesting things. Like she had actually written a paper or something about this whole debate. So she was quite informed about it. And there is a book that was also pretty, seminal in like Milton studies by a critic named Stanley Fish, who is, I don't know, I'm sure Johnny probably heard of him. Stanley Fish is, I don't know, like a pretty well-respected critic. He was probably famous for really developing, I think, like reader response theory, which like kind of locates the meaning of the text within the reader, like how the reader interprets it, as opposed to looking at like within the text or within the artist or whatever. But this, my friend pointed out that Stanley Fish's book, which came out in the 70s, and I think is called something about sin. And sin is interesting to think about too in this context, like how we understand sin. I don't remember the title, but if you put in Stanley Fish Sin Milton book, you'll find it in Google. But Stanley Fish argued that there's a middle way, and I don't agree with this at all, by the way, but this is what Stanley Fish says, and my friend probably thinks. There's a middle way between the Blake and Shelley interpretations, which are basically Milton was of the devil's party and was a true poet, and the Christian humanist interpretation, C.S. Lewis, which was that Satan embodies a demonological and we should resist him at every step. Stanley Fish says, no, because of what Jeffrey importantly pointed out, and we talked about a little bit, between the narrator and Satan and the subtle frisson that happens between those perspectives. And by the way, that's all, that should always be considered. The relationship between the narrator and the character, the persona, we always need to think about like first person, third person consciousness. It's just like super important. But so Stanley Fish said that because we are navigating between this first person, I don't know, is it first person? I guess it is, narrator and third person Satan, although it's also, there's something called free indirect discourse, I guess, is where the third person and the first person kind of blend because the narrator enters into the third person and soliloquizes and so on. That because of that confluence or dynamic relationship, we as the reader become more perceptive and more discerning about the role that Satan plays. And therefore, Stanley Fish argues, according to my friend, that this is actually an ethical way of looking at the text. Because we as readers, through really thinking about the book, become more perceptive and discerning. That's actually, I find that really interesting. I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I really do find myself more in the Blake, Shelley, Bloom, Empson camps. But it's a different perspective, you know? And at least to me, it's more plausible than the C.S. Lewis take, which I find I don't like it at all. I find it utterly not reading the text right.
Can I ask a question, Andrew?
Yeah.
I love what you were saying about the romanticism, and I think that's right on. I'm not quite sure how readers felt about Milton and Satan, because I'm so immersed in the romantic orientation.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the Enlightenment period thinkers thought very much like C.S. Lewis did. But I think the question I have for you, I don't know if this is a fair question or an interesting one for you, is that the Shelley, Bloom, Empson camp, what about Whitman? What would Whitman's relationship be to Milton Satan? I don't know. I'm just opening that up since we recently started studying Whitman.
Are you asking that because when we talked about the runaway slave, there was sort of ethical. Is that
I also was thinking about what you were talking about and the ellipses, and the presence of the ellipses in the runaway slave section and the other section with the 27 bathers. There was an ellipses as well, and your curiosity about the presence of the ellipses, and I didn't ask you then, but I can ask you now because I thought about that. And I had to figure that out for myself. Well, what is that, are that ellipses about? But I was wondering what happens right before the ellipses in the runaway slave section. And then what happens after the ellipses in that section? And then you could contrast and compare in the next session in the 27 bathers, the ellipses in that section, what happens right before and what happens right after. And then you could look at both of those ellipses in both of those sections and you could probably fill in a lot of gaps. But I think that's what's happening as you were talking about the in-between, the first person narrator and the blending of first person, third person in the in Satan, and the increase in perception that can happen in the reader. I think there's something in between those first person, third person interplays that is sort of similar, and this is pretty wacky, I admit, that may have that has something to do with what Whitman was doing with his ellipses. Because it's a space that you don't know what's going on there. But you know that it's in the text and it has to be dealt with. And I believe it comes perhaps for me out of something that is perhaps maybe Whitman just did not have any adequate words to express. Or maybe he felt some censorship in his own performance there. He was censoring himself because he could not say out loud certain things about runaway slaves, because it was illegal to assist a runaway slave. You could go to jail and be fined a large sum of money if you assisted a slave in running away. So I hope there's some connections that are being made here. I'm just thinking a little bit out loud, but I think the romantic view of Satan is the one that I'm most familiar with. And I was just thinking about, along with Shelley and Bloom and Empson, would Whitman be in that party? Definitely, yeah. I think he's a romantic.
Yeah.
He has a romantic streak.
I think those are really good questions. I guess one thing to say would be that I think Whitman is really relevant to think about the romantic interpretation. And he also is really relevant in terms of first person, third person consciousness.
Yeah.
Although I personally don't know if I would frame that in terms of like first person, third person in Milton and ellipses in Whitman. I would think about, actually, one way to think about it is the catalogs in Whitman, which is when Whitman literally like catalogs these third person orchestrations of what is happening in the world, you know, line by line by line, and they're like a total profusion, cornucopia of amazing things that are also totally plain and like ordinary. But when they're refracted through Whitman's vision, they take on a sort of grandeur. And that is also his first person, third person in a way. But yeah, so there's that. But the other thing is that in terms of reading Whitman in terms of the context of the romantic vein of interpreting Paradise Lost, yes, I do think Whitman does fit within that. And this is why. Whitman is very, very deceiving when you read him, because he's plain spoken. He's famous for being plain spoken. Any, you know, stop with me and you can get all the meanings of poems. You know, have you reckoned 1,000 acres much, or, you know, whatever. But it's deceiving, because Milton is utterly hermetic as a poet, I would argue. Utterly hermetic, and can and should be read in the context of like what you were saying, John, about Gnosis, I don't know how to say the word, or even Gnosticism. And I personally do find Gnosticism utterly fascinating. I've been reading about it a lot lately, and relevant for interpreting literature. Although I have to confess that is very Bloomian. Bloom is calls himself a Jewish Gnostic. And I'd love to explore at some point in our discussions the parallels, maybe is that the word, between Gnosticism and Paradise Lost. So I think they're there. I don't know, maybe if they're sometimes kind of like echoes or something, but they're relevant for thinking about it. But yes, I personally do read Whitman as being hermetic, and that his plain spokenness is really deceiving, and that there's a level of like subtlety and, like, to use an overused term, spirituality when it comes to Whitman that should be discussed, because he's a visionary and he's a seer, and so is Milton. Yeah.
So that's really interesting, because one of the things I was thinking as I was listening to the to you guys talk is that the sort of this whole argument about Milton is because to a certain, I mean, we have a civilization, Western civilization in particular, has lived for a long time with the sort of, it came out of the Enlightenment, the kind of rational argument. People that literature and what is expressed in literature is a consistent, coherent argument, but people aren't consistent. And there's, I mean, you know, and so it's the, it's in a way, it's the excluded middle and the, and the, and the logic of either or, right? But today we know that humans don't operate on an either or organization of the psyche. The psyche includes many different possibilities, and we don't have to choose one or another, you know, in terms of, so there's this, so I do feel that some of these discussions, like between the Christian group and the romanticists, that you have to choose one understanding over another, or that Milton had one idea about God and the devil and not another, to be a little bit overly purist, because I think we know the way human, you know, it's one of the reasons why Milton's text is so powerful, because it speaks to us in both registers. It speaks to us in this idea that the fallen angels and the devils are not all bad, and they speak to something in us directly. And yet they also, his argument also speaks to us in a level of, well, we are concerned about doing good and not necessarily doing harm to other people, because that's ultimately the argument about good and evil, whether you interpret it in a religious framework or not. And we're concerned about both those things. And Milton is concerned about both those things. So do we have to choose one argument over the other? You know, I mean, I understand in discourse, you may choose to support one discourse over another, but I do think we need to be careful around this idea of either or thinking about these things.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that, if that's okay. Okay, so I am all for acknowledging ambiguity and ambivalence and gray areas. You know, yes. Having said that, I really do believe in, like, that there are qualitative differences in interpretations. And I really do think some interpretations are some ways better than other interpretations. I think that's something I really believe in. And I also think that, like, when you interpret a text a certain way, it has massive ramifications, not just in terms of, like, the textual aspect, but in terms of your lived reality. Like, I honestly think that most of the Christian humanists who interpret Paradise Lost through that lens, through the C.S. Lewis lens, seem to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's something, like, pragmatically different about the whole lifestyle that suggests than, like, the Blake Shelley interpretation. And when I have to, like, choose between interpretations or theories, which is also, in a sense, lifestyles, I much more resonate with the Romantics, which I feel is actually a better interpretation and a lifestyle. Like, Christian humanism with the notion of, like, sin and guilt, and, like, there's a whole world behind the word Christian humanism. It's not just a theory. It's a lifestyle. You know, like, go ahead.
But can you, I mean, you know, I agree with you, but and I would choose the romantic approach over the Christian purist approach any day of the week. But there are many people who do So, you know, incorporate that approach.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I'm not denying
And why are they necessarily wrong? Because I think the wrong and the right has to do with what you're saying. It has to do with our lifestyle and our values. And so the romantic values fit better with my values than the Christian values, which is why I like that approach. But I don't disagree with the Christian arguments over their internal logic, right?
For sure there's internal logic. But like one other thing I would just say is that, like, again, going to Bloom, because I'm always reading Bloom, he edited like hundreds of volumes about literature, literally hundreds of volumes. And they're published by a publisher called Chelsea House. And they're great because you can find them in public libraries and in academic libraries. And they're about like anything and everything related to literature. Like certain artists, certain movements, certain characters, they're all under Chelsea House. They're great. And they're at a high level of discourse, so they're good. So he actually has one about C.S. Lewis, which is crazy to me because he knew C.S. Lewis and they hated each other. In his introduction to C.S. Lewis, he reflects upon his actual life in relation to C.S. Lewis. Like, Bloom apparently knew C.S. Lewis when he was in his 20s. He went to London, I think, on some fellowship, and C.S. Lewis was there, and they would talk a lot. And then they had a falling out because of basically the romantic versus the Christian humanist. And
although Lewis came to Christianity late in life, it wasn't an early choice.
Yeah, when Bloom met Lewis, he was probably in his 50s or his 60s.
Yeah.
And Bloom acknowledges that Lewis he's a good scholar of medievalism. But Bloom says this, and I think he's right, and I think it's indicative of the Christian humanist stance. He says that C.S. Lewis was not a questions man. He was an answers man. Mm-hmm. He didn't care about the questions. He was dogmatic, and he was orthodox. And Bloom said he was the most dogmatic and aggressive person he'd ever met in his life. So when I talk to my friend who reads Paradise Lost, who loves C.S. Lewis, I feel like she's bringing her answers to the text, and she's reading it through the lens of those answers. And that's okay, but it's a veil between, I don't know how to put it. It just seems more ideological, more dogmatic, and more in love with the answers than the questions. And I think if you come to Paradise Lost without the answers, I think you begin to resonate with Satan because of the deliciousness. Yeah. And that's why I guess I feel like that interpretation is closer to the actual lived reality of the text than the Christian humanist stands. Yeah.
But I do think that, because you started off saying that Milton is pure of heart, and we do sense that. And so even though he was explaining, and as you say, it was a kind of vision of Paradise Lost. And so even though he is presenting the darkness and the evil and the negatives, the fallen side, as having much more positive values one would normally ascribe to, ultimately, you're not sure that's really what he's about, right? Because he has this other side to him. And that's part of what feeds this argument between the two camps. There are more than two, but anyway, it's not as, you can't just say it's all the one thing or the other. There are these different arguments inside that, and your own arguments about Whitman underline that. So Whitman also has these slightly, these different distances in the poetry, right? So that you can read Whitman as a straightforward exposition of somebody just saying what they think. And yet you can also read it with a somewhat different distance. And some of the critics do that, right? And that's part of human makeup, that you have these different distances, these different understandings. And when Milton writes at one point, he may be writing all Lucifer. And then when he writes at a different point, he may be writing much more divine God orienting. And those are still both part of his makeup, right? So,
but, I mean, if you actually look at, like, Milton's religious writings, like, they're not Christian humanist. Like, he was an anti-Trinitarian.
But there wasn't Christian humanism in the same way at that time. That's a more modern lens for understanding Milton.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation a lot because I think it's achieving something that I had hoped for, which is a real a blend between the comparativist and that sort of phenomenological aspect that I'm drawn to. And if I can get inside the text and embody it, then I can reflect. I have something to reflect upon. And I can compare different kinds of readings in ways that create some sort of coherence rather than more decoherence. So I think that's a challenge in a group, especially because I want for us to maintain a quality of attention so that we can enjoy a greater coherent we space. And so many of the perils of the humanities seems to me that there wasn't enough attention paid to the quality of a we space. And it just seemed to be a lot of people flying by the seat of their pants. And I think you've addressed this issue, Andrew, in your experience in academia and higher education, and how the humanities are in shambles. And I think there's a broad consensus the humanities 20 years from now will not be what they are today, if the humanities are even around. It seems like to create a career right now with the obstacles that you'd have to deal with, pretty insurmountable. But I think this is all pointing to something that's in the text, actually, the stability and the chaos. If things were so good in heaven, why would they rebel? Were they just bored out of their minds with all that bliss?
That's a great question.
And I think that the answer is yes. I think they were bored shitless. And this is something extremely human. And because, as we said yesterday, we're complex beings, and there's compelling reasons for us to stay the same, and there are compelling reasons for us to change. And each of us has to deal with that the best way we can, because these are demands upon us. And every culture goes through this, and every civilization goes through it. And I think we should think in terms of like that crash. What was it? That Lewontin and Gould, they talked about evolution is not steady and progressive and slow incremental change.
Yeah,
it's actually about crash. Yeah. It's destabilized and the system totally crashes and something else happens, but it's not anything anyone could have predicted. And I think that's what's happening here too, is in the history of religion or the history of poetry. It's too easy if you take a big view of things and say, oh, this fits there, that fits there, that fits there, and we have something called progress. I think it's much messier than that. And I think definitely Milton was writing after enormous cultural crash had occurred. And I think he's trying to go through the ruins and find out, well, what can I pick out of this mess and to create some sort of reconstruction, I think. In Milton, an effort to reconstruct something workable out of a huge disaster.
So, Andrew, do you need to get going? It's about your time.
Yeah, pretty soon. I kind of need to get my game together and get going pretty soon. Yeah.
Well, we'll get ready to wrap up. But Doug, is Doug still here?
Yeah, he still is. Just on chat.
Doug, you're outside.
Saving battery.
got a fire alarm pulled or something. Maybe it's just a test, but I was kicked out of the library, so I thought that was very fitting for our
maybe they thought that the flames of hell were taking over the library.
Probably got a report from the person next to me in the other room. Like, there's some satanic person about to start a fire in the other room.
Now you're outdoors, you can yell and scream all you want. Or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe they'll...
So do we want to keep going with the Milton next time, or do we want to switch to Blake? I mean, it could be...
I'm sort of attracted to Blake, having read this bit of Milton.
I feel we've done an intro, and we probably have enough to at least begin the Blake Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Although it takes us to a very different place to do that. That's all I want to say about it, you know?
I'm all for that, if that's okay with you.
Do we want to perhaps wait and see what happens? I know it's braided with savagery, so perhaps we can see how we respond to that recording before we make any final decision. But yeah
well let's aim for Blake.
Introduce Blake.
Yeah, let's aim for Blake. Person.
Okay.
Yeah, does somebody else want to lead that discussion? I'm happy to do so, but...
I'm happy for you to do that too, unless Andrew, you would like to lead it, or Doug? I'm okay with other people leading it. I can be the rebel.
Yeah, you can be the rebel angel. Yeah, you're very good at that, actually.
you figured out my strategy.
I'll do the Blake. I mean, I am studying Blake right now, so it is a good topic for me to engage with. So, I think is it 2 weeks now? Yeah, I guess it is in 2 weeks because Savitri is next week, and then so in 2 weeks we'll be doing this.
Thank you all. I'm going to take the rebel out into the streets with me, out into Manhattan.
So it's great reading. It's a wonderful way to read Milton and to discuss it. I really enjoyed the discussion. So.
Me too. Thank you all, and have a great day.
And you too.
Bye, everyone.
See you next time.